You're in a Click with your host, Jamily Baroud, and today I have the pleasure of introducing you to Alec Kouros. How are you doing, Alec?
I'm doing all right, yeah. I have the five-year-old somewhere around here. He might peep in or at some point.
But I hope so.
No, he might be around. He's being a YouTuber at the moment, so I give him a few minutes to do that. And yeah, everything else is good, just winding down with classes and so on. Mm. So it's nice to actually feel like I'm going to get a break. I just put in my marks yesterday, my grades yesterday, so.
Oh, good. Congratulations. Thank you for taking the time to do this. I know.
Oh, yeah, no worries at all. I'm glad it actually worked out. So.
So I guess just to begin with, for the listeners who don't know, could you just explain a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I'm a teacher. I'm a professor of educational technology and media at the University of Regina. I've been there about 20 years. That's been where I found home, but I end up spending a lot of time on the road speaking about pedagogy, speaking about social media technology. And the technology aspect is everything from the integration of technology into teaching and learning to the impact of social media on teen life, exploring some of the new technologies and websites that are coming out and apps that come out that influence our young people. Mm. So that's a big part of what I do. It really taking a more critical perspective to technology and helping parents, teachers, students understand what the impact of these technologies is on their life and on the lives of others.
Absolutely. There was one quote that I found from an interview on your website that I really appreciated. And you said that digital tools will come and go, but relationships will always matter.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you could explain the context of that quote a little bit and kind of the motivations behind the comment.
Well, I think it was that, if I remember correctly, that was actually a reflection from a dean who had left at some point. It was Dr. Michael Timchuk, who was a dean of education here for some time. And he actually went back, he threw back to a story during his retirement, and he talked about how he had visited his homestead at one point, and he found, I think there was a piece of a shoe or something in the dirt. And he talked about the concept of what actually endures, what endures in our lives. You know, things come and go, but what actually stays, what remains, what remains important. And, you know, thinking of back to my, career on social media, for a long time, I've got lots of Twitter followers and friends, people for the last, I've been on Twitter since 2006, probably, and I've made really some really strong relationships. But at the same time, if Twitter were to blow up to tomorrow, would I have a way to connect with those people? Would I have a way into their lives, to people's lives, people that I actually care for? And it's not just about getting their SMS or getting some other social contact, but do we have a relationship outside of the tool? Or is the tool the thing that draws us together? Is there something more to the relationships? And I think it's really important that we move beyond sort of the relationality that we see in social media and move towards deeper friendships. And this is, it's interesting because I've gone back and forth on this concept. If you think of Granovetter's work, he coined this term, the strength of weak ties. And I think it's great that we have, we can do some really cool things on social media with just weak connections through hashtags and all sorts of collaboration. Mm-hmm. But there's also the time that we need to dig deeper and try to create those really strong ties as well, those strong relationships that we have. So I think that's a big part of it is, at the end of the day, if some of the tools were to evaporate, would we be able to keep those free, those really strong ties, and to consider what endures beyond the relationships that we have on social media?
Right.
It kind of puts you into a space where you're communicating in a certain way, like SMS has changed mm-hmm. everything in the way that we relate to each other. We have a different freedom to speak in a different way, to communicate in different patterns that allow us to be a bit jocular, to to be less serious, to annoy someone by putting punctuation in at the end of the sentence. it's really interesting how that's taken on its own language and how the medium itself has allowed us to communicate in different ways. is. Yeah, and I think it's for those, you know, when we're thinking about how we might annoy one another or how we communicate our expressions of sadness, anger, whatever else, it's really important for young people. Like for a while there was they still use the tech terminology. Kids aren't necessarily on Facebook anymore, but they, when they were on Facebook, there might be, say, a teen girl, and we're thinking, you know, during the mean girl phase of, you know, 8, 9, 10, she might be having a bad day, and she'd say something sort of, a partial, you know, like, I had such a horrible day, but without any details. And that might be something like vague booking that they, vague booking is kind of signaling your friends to say, you know, ask me about what's going on. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to say or dish all the drama online, but I do want to, you know, get some support. So there's that vague expression of like, I need a connection. I need someone to come see me or talk to me, or, and sometimes these are, more for, you know, something maybe a bit trivial, but in some cases, these are really serious mental health issues. So it's really interesting how young people have taken to, the medium to express, real emotions when they perhaps feel that they can't. Like, sometimes the social media doesn't allow us to do so. So they've hacked it in some ways to actually express themselves and to get support when they need it.
Yeah, absolutely. That actually leads to my next question. And so one of the features of your work revolves around kind of the fear of social media and learning. And I think that that has a lot to do with it, right? Because what I've learned a lot in the literature is that majority of teachers, when they do integrate technology, it is for the purpose of ensuring that students are kind of good online citizens, right? It's about informing you about online bullying. But I think that the focus on kind of the negative aspects of social media is also one of the hindrances for incorporating it. And so, because I found this in my own research, I'm just curious to ask you about what is your response to teachers who are afraid of teaching the social media for that reason? And how do we grapple with the possible negative aspects and then begin to look at them in a positive way?
I mean, that's a huge question. Yeah. And really, but it's so integral to my approach, I think. For the longest time in the 90s, we scared kids online. We just kept them offline. We would make up all sorts of cyber predators that didn't exist, sort of like the boogeyman to kind of keep kids complacent and doing what we wanted them to do. But as they explored, because kids are curious, they ended up on these online spaces, finding connections. The mall culture of the 1980s, where kids just went to the mall and hung out, that was sort of dead as we kind of created these suburbias. And so kids weren't able to connect in the face-to-face spaces, like the rinks dried up, the libraries dried up, like there were the terrestrial spaces sort of just dissipated. And so we were left with kids looking for connection and without the ability to do other than digital media. And so that's where we are in many cases right now. Like we're kind of in that space right now. And so a more realistic view of the web and understanding how kids connect and giving them, you know, the tools to navigate these spaces, to have, you know, real discussions around what it means to, you know, when you give away your geolocation on Snapchat, like, what does that actually mean? And, you know, I've talked to teachers, they say, I don't want to let them know about that sort of thing, because then they'll start using it. But the reality is they already know about it. They don't want you to know about it. And perhaps they don't have enough of a context to understand, you know, perhaps it's okay to give it to some of the friends that I know, but perhaps everyone doesn't need to know where I am at all times. And perhaps I need to close that off at times. And maybe I need to turn my phone off at night because it's really interrupting my sleep pattern. But I'm a kid going through this life the very first time, and I don't have the context to understand what good sleep means.
Right. So or that it matters.
Right. Or that, you know, maybe this short, you know, the short text, we're not getting, you know, full relationships, and maybe we need more balance. And, you know, these are kids doing this for the very first time without the history and without understanding what healthy relationships look like or what healthy, you know, sleep and wellness looks like. And so I think it's really important that we have very, very upfront conversations. At the same time, I think adults have to spend more time in these spaces, not necessarily bugging their kids or tracking their kids, but having fun with other adults, understanding what TikTok is and dance or something, you know, just hanging out and having some fun.
I'm going to assume that many people listening also don't know what TikTok is. So could you just explain that?
Well, TikTok came from Musical.ly. Musical.ly was, in some listeners may remember Musical.ly, it was kind of a lip dubbing type software. So you, or an app, I guess. And so you, you know, look at some of your favorite songs and you kind of dance around to the songs. And then it sort of, the company that owned Musical.ly at the same time, Vine, which was notable for its very short 6-second videos, which were kind of amazingly addictive at the same time. These two sort of media kind of came together. And so what TikTok is really people lip dubbing typically to music, but also to dialogue or whatever it might be, or developing other media. It's very short. It's quite entertaining in many cases. People who watch something can imitate or duet with whatever you've seen. So for instance, I mean, the TikTok, I mentioned the Get Up. You know, there's this Blanco Brown who basically was a kind of a hip hop artist who did country at the same time. And so he created this, he put a dance tutorial on online. And then some kid, I forget what his name is, but he's like a, you know, grade 9 kid, he looks like. He's a young kid. He kind of does this dance that the artist did, but even to a, kind of even did it much better. And then people mimic this kid over and over and over again, but not in a bullying way. They were venerating this kid. They were, like, they were really...
The highest form of a compliment.
It really was, right? They were dancing to this. They were creating variations. And it went from this one kid dancing alone at his school to, you know, stadiums of people doing the same dance and all trying to emulate and share his joy and his happiness. And it was just kind of an amazing thing to see this. And then, you know, the artist comes back into the, and it's weird how the ebb and flow of who's the artist, who's the meme maker, who's the, you know, it becomes much more organic. And so it's not just that, but there's all sorts of dances and memes. Now there's all sorts of negative stuff on there. There's, you know, racially problematic and, you know, gender, you know, sort of all sorts of issues of misogyny and everything that we would see in a face-to-face world. But that's what we have to remember, is that the online world is a reflection of us, the bad, the good. And it's okay that we go into these spaces as long as we have someone to make, help us make sense of those things, right? We have people that can, you know, participate and help us.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are third parties to...
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I hear the little monster in the background.
Yeah, oh yeah.
The video's getting a little bit wild. That's so cute. So I guess my next question, and if you don't feel comfortable answering it, that's totally okay. I was just thinking, in the process of having this conversation, I'm wondering, what is your perspective on the cell phone ban that's happening in Ontario schools right now? And relatedly, what's your instructional advice to teachers who want to integrate SNS or digital technologies and have to navigate this new policy?
I think it's reckless. I think it's reckless, and I think it defies professional autonomy of teachers. I think for the most part, many teachers in Ontario, and I've got many colleagues that I've worked with, and I've worked with many schools in Ontario, you know, teachers are already making sense of, they know, or they have reasonably good classroom management strategies that deal with all of these different devices coming into the classroom. Schools have good policy. So in some ways, it's a politicalized version of something that's already been happening in some ways, that teachers have, you know, like, I think the policy itself is that, you know, for academic work, it can still be reported. It can still be used, but, you know, there's a general ban on, you know, kids just hanging out and TikToking or whatever it might be in the class, or texting each other or snapping each other. So I think, again, there's a politicized piece, but I think ultimately teachers have, they need the education around how to deal with all of these different devices. Many of them do have, and I think a number of prominent boards in Ontario have done that, and have reasonable policies around that. But when I say it's reckless, it's because kids need support with these devices, whether it's the appropriate or inappropriate content, whether it's their self-regulation, the understanding of when and when not to use it, how to use it professionally, knowing, you know, what sort of messages and understanding digital footprint, you know, what to put out there and how to frame yourself, how to frame your identity, you know, privacy and security. These are all things that need to be address in the K-12 curriculum. And they have been doing it. Many teachers have been doing this through, you know, the idea of digital citizenship, which isn't perfect, but at least it does provide some background to this. So I think it's, you know, thinking of, I've seen lots of great strategies when it comes to bring your own device, BYOD, which you often see in literature. I've seen, for instance, examples of teachers putting up kind of a stoplight system in their classroom. So they might have, you know, when I have a green light, that means students are able to use their devices any way they'd like. If it's an amber light, that means that you can use it, but only for schoolwork. If it's a red light, then you can only, you can't use your devices at all. So that scaffolds sort of a self-regulatory process for students, that they understand that there's times where they need to put away their phones, times that they could use it, and that there's also a reasonable use, a reasonable need to use it through schoolwork or through something professional. I think those types of things are really important. There's also all sorts of things that you can, like you can ask, it's like a phone check-in system, where I've seen students, you know, are required to put their phones away in a check-in kind of system. There's sort of lockers, I guess, or there's different types of devices. I know you can hear my little guy right
now. Yeah, he's so cute.
there's a lot of different strategies for this that, again, scaffold that self-regulatory process. And I think that's an important piece.
Yeah, access to affordable technology in schools is already quite difficult for many people and for many teachers. And so when we're asking students to, just in case. So when we're asking students to not bring in their cell phones, the schools aren't providing these technologies, then we're just we're just creating a bigger divide for these students who like then don't have any practice using these tools.
So I think that's a really good point. I mean, and you hear of these Silicon Valley parents, right? Like the rich, you know, kids of their parents are like Silicon Valley professionals. And so you get wind of those particular articles and you hear all these, you know, the people that work in Silicon Valley aren't allowing their kids to have cell phones, but it is really about access. Those kids have all sorts of access technology outside of school that many people don't have access to. So I think it's incredibly important that we do think of access, as you mentioned.
Absolutely. And then you also use the word Twitter, and mentioned that educational leaders use good practice on Twitter. And so I'm just wondering what you mean by good practice on Twitter and how we could emulate that in our own practice.
Well, okay, good practice. I mean, connecting would be part of it. So in the literature, there's a lot around personal learning networks or personal learning environments. So this idea that, I'm not constrained to the minds in my school. Like if you look at education in general, it's rather individualistic. Like the idea that we can look into a book or watch a video and then learn something, I mean, that's only partial, that's only part of the learning process. Typically in our schools, we might, and if we look at various examples of how we might develop networks, you can develop them locally. I think we call it glocally. I think there's, I'm trying to think of who at the U of T does this. It'll come to me later. Do you want me to?
Oh my God, no, I adore it. It's okay. Great. It's great.
Okay, that's right. You're hearing the real chatter in the
background noise.
So thinking about our school networks and our communities, how we connect with people. Like the other day, I had an intern at the school, and the intern's dad, who's an interning teacher, her dad's a firefighter. So you bring the firefighter in, you're connecting with real knowledge. But, you know, we can't, we're not necessarily limited to communities that are around us. So if we want to learn about, you know, what are cultural practices around food across the planet? What I've seen is, you know, a kindergarten teacher or grade one teacher, Kathy Cassidy from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, for instance, she'll put out a poll on Google Docs, tweet it out, and just ask the question, what did you have for lunch today? And so you get respondents from people around the world who said, you know, I had bacon and eggs, or, you know, you might get something from England that says eggs and beans or whatever it might be. Something that, you know, the grade one kids in Moose Jaw are like, ew, you know, they don't like the English breakfast, for instance. And so what you do is you do that. You map it on the globe, because you can really easily take that geo data along with that food data and basically create a cool little interactive map. So that would be one step. Then you're linking geography with culture. And then the next step is, why don't we bring in some communication skills, some ELA skills, and we might connect with, the teacher might, and very transparently, show how you might connect to this teacher that happens to be in London. And so you basically model that those interactions about how you might create an interview. You verify that person is real. And then you set up a Skype call with the classroom, and the classroom might ask that teacher a number of different things, and you share cultural practices. Those two classrooms might be linked. And so that to me is, you know, this whole scaffolding and modeling, and the teacher's got the technology. The kids aren't tweeting, the kids aren't, you know, sending out messages, but the teacher is, and you're seeing, I mean, this is a very zone of peripheral, development, where they're actually seeing what a teacher can do and modeling that particular the way of networking and authenticating information and generating connection. And you're doing this there, and the teacher, and of course the kids are learning everything that's a byproduct of this process.
Right. Absolutely.
Like, I've seen a good examples of like a grade one teacher might have a worksheet that actually has 140 blank letters where they might write a suggested tweet. Then the tweet goes to the classroom. The classroom talks about whether this is something that should be tweeted or not, and then they might send it out. But I mean, this sort of idea, they can talk about those things. Is it healthy? Is it useful? Like, who would it go to? What is your audience? And some for a very young age. And grade one seems unreasonable to some people, and that's understandable. But we're not talking about them using the devices. We also have to think that at the age of 9, like only 4 years later, those kids are probably going to send their first social media message. Mm-hmm. So why not scaffold and prepare them for that first message in the years before that?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that, especially because it's the process of critically thinking about what you're producing. Right. It's not physically producing it yet. So that scaffolding has to happen at one point or another. And if they're already engaging with that device, then that scaffolding, we kind of lost that opportunity to scaffold.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to be too late. Like, the average age is around nine years of age when they're sending their first social media profile.
9 years old.
Social media message. So that's a bit scary if you think about that. That's a 9-year-old kid.
Right. And not really understanding what a digital footprint is and what the implications are. I certainly didn't when I was 9. Right. I mean, I didn't have a cell phone at that point, but
I'm not sure if we still do, right?
I had a pager, I think.
Yeah, well, I missed the whole paging thing. I remember Doogie Howser having one, but
I can't believe how much things have progressed. Yeah. I'm just wondering, what's kind of the most exciting either tool or approach that you've used in your classroom most recently that has just been, that has been a great learning process for you, but that your students have also really appreciated?
It's something that I've been doing for quite some time. It's the learning project process I do in my grad courses. And I just finished a grad course, just grading it this week. Mm. And it's really, students who are typically teachers or adult trainers of some sort, they're involved in education because they work with other kids or adults to learn. And so in this project, what we do is we document some learning. So we might, my grad students take up something like piano or guitar or coding or something that they've never had a chance to actually take up. Something that they've always wanted to learn, but never had the institutional space to take up. And they document their learning throughout the semester. And so they might be quite novice, and that's the point, is hopefully you're a novice in this, and then you use all the internet resources, and we're talking about like YouTube videos, but also like connecting to people that might be teachers online. Hmm. Or teachers in your community. I've had people that, I had a girl in my undergraduate course who felt disconnected from her indigenous culture, and she had never really had a chance to really explore, some of the aspects of that. And so she took up beading, and she ended up as her final part of that creating moccasins, which were amazing. But it really allowed her to connect to not just the internet resources, but also community resources. So she worked with elders, straight, and something that she'd never done before. Mm-hmm. So it was really kind of a nice networking process. But it's about learning, considering what it means to be a novice again, because often as teachers, we never get a chance to do that anymore. Documenting the learning process, which brings us much closer to understanding all the types of multimedia and formative assessment that we can use in our, you know, rich assessment that we can use in our classrooms. Mm-hmm. And then being vulnerable, you know, failing, you know, all of those emotions that come with that, but also the opportunities that come with failure. And so those things are really amazing. And, you know, just thinking, one of the things I tweeted out not too long ago is, you know, I had one person learning guitar, one person learning piano, and one person just happens to have a great voice on her. And so these two students who are in the class, they're, you know, publishing YouTube videos, singing, and they're quite, you know, happy with, you know, with the product. I was very happy with the product, but it was amazing to see people connect and collaborate in ways that they've never done before. And it's not just about music, but it was just, I mean, the idea is failure, process, that the process of learning, being vulnerable and being also at the same time to establish a bit of a positive digital footprint. So that if their students see this, this is the type of thing that you'd want to see from them as well. Something that's creative and kind and caring online.
What a humbling process.
It is, yeah. And I think, you know, the part that we may have missed as well is, you know, when we explain something to students, I love those videos online where you see a really bright, you know, like an expert on a topic and having to explain the same concept to a five-year-old, to an eight-year-old, to a mm-hmm. undergrad, to a grad student, to a, you know, a colleague. And just seeing how, like, understanding that it does take, like, there's lots that we have to understand about what people already know and how we can actually, again, scaffold that information to them and how we can explain things in different ways. And so that really helps us become better teachers.
Right, and in multimodal ways as well.
Right. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like learning that there is not one correct way to teach something or one correct way to represent your knowledge.
Yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately, I think there's still this kind of paradigm around traditional literacies and where it's really difficult for us to break from that. But when you open up those possibilities, you find that students know much more than you originally thought that they did. They just simply can't represent that necessarily in a paper. My next question for you is just what motivates or inspires you to do what you do, and what is your ultimate goal for the field of educational technology?
You know, my kids obviously are, I've got four. I've got a five.
Four kids?
Yeah, four kids, 5, 9, 12, and 15.
Okay.
And they're really the inspiration to everything. And seeing mm-hmm. from the very young ones, you know, just kind of learning how to do some of the basic things online to, you know, the savviness that kind of grows with media and technology as they grow. And then of course, thinking about like my 15-year-old struggled in her school this year because of bullying and that sort of thing. So understanding what it means to be a teen again in a space where it's bad. And I think sometimes schools are bad enough and can be toxic at times and to no fault of the teacher and teachers and admin, but just that's just what happens in adolescence sometimes. So we see that, and then that's of course the amplification of issues that we have around mental health, around teen, you know, sharing of intimate images, mm-hmm. the sexting, you know, all of that stuff that happens in those particular spaces, that is really problematic. And so I guess a big what inspires me is making sure that I can hopefully contribute to schools that are going to be better equipped to handle some of the emerging issues, because I want my kids to be safe in those schools, and I of course want other kids to be safe in those schools. But overall, you know, on a more positive note, seeing the incredible you know, sharing of content, the generosity of people in my network, I could not possibly do the things that I do today in my classes if it wasn't for the idea collision of, you know, thousands of Twitter profiles and YouTube. You know, yesterday I tweeted something around, it was a Wired video of this incredible, amazing piano composer who basically broke down 16 levels of piano composition. And it was amazing to me that this person is not a teacher. This person is someone who knows their craft, their artistic talent so well that they're able to communicate it in such a beautiful way. And so when I think about instructional design and pedagogy and the way that we inform our students, we have to look much more broadly to content creators online who do what we've always strived to as teachers. But they do it in very creative ways. Not saying that it's more creative, it's just a different type of creativity that we can be informed by, that we can bring into our classrooms. And so reading broadly, understanding what people are sharing out there in multiple contexts, not just teacher context, is so incredibly important for our profession, so important for how we communicate what we know and what we can learn to our students. So I think, you know, just thinking broadly about what learning means in the network age is kind of an amazing idea.
And it continuously changes, which is exciting. It's an exciting field to be a part of and to learn with. Yeah. Have you heard of Amy Hazanov?
I haven't.
Well,
my fingers feel itchy, so I'm going to have to.
Yeah, please. She's a professor. I forget now, in the States. I believe it's in Colorado. Anyway, she does a lot of work on sexting. Yeah. And I interviewed her a few weeks back and it was so informative. She gave some really practical tips on how to incorporate it inside the classroom. And she's also been working to address policy in the States, because right now, if you send a nude image then and you're under the age of 18, you're not protected if that person sends your image out, because it's technically you produce child pornography.
It's interesting, even in the legislative context of Canada, like there are, you know, similar issues that you allude to. I mean, there was a Nova Scotia case where there was five boys who kind of solicited photos from 20 plus girls. And then doing that, if there's person to person consent, it's actually protected under consent laws, broader consent laws in Canada. But when it comes to, you know, distribution, that, you know, comes with much harsher penalties, even for young offenders. And so that's what they did, is once they put it onto Dropbox to share with, you know, the larger community, that becomes distribution of child pornography. So the legal ramifications are one thing. And of course, just the mental health stresses, the bullying that comes with that is just, it's mind blowing. And, you know, and I think of bullying as a, you know, growing up without this technology, it was very easy. If someone got really bullied, they would move to a different community and that was the end of it. Whereas you look at like Amanda Todd's perspective, you go to a different school and the bullying follows you. It doesn't matter what you do to hide.
It's so devastating. The fact that we're not, I think many of us aren't incorporating it into our teaching because it's so controversial is an issue.
It's very much the abstinence only versus safe sex initiatives or mindsets, because we look at the literature already and there's already safer sexting practice, but that means acknowledging that kids are flirtatious and that they send images of some sort, like acknowledging those things that are outside of our, you know, because it's very easy for adults to say, don't send images. Mm. We know that when we say something to a kid,
they're going
to
do it.
Send images, they'll probably do it twice as fast.
Yeah.
Right. But when we start to think about, have you developed trusting relationships? What types of images do you send? Do you share your headshot, you know, attached to those things? Like there are things that you can actually talk about. Mm-hmm. And again, this is not necessarily encouraging, and it's sort of like backdooring in some ways, saying that we don't really want you to do this, but if you're going to do it, we want you to be informed about it. And we know that, when we look at, statistics around it, we're already seeing a decline when people actually are informed. And it's the same thing that happens, and you look at Texas, which is, or forbids the safer sexting, safe sex sort of curriculum, you see the highest number of teen pregnancies. So it's the same sort of mindset that we have to be very thoughtful about. When we do say no, it's going to be more prominent, more prevalent. And then there's more restrictions on what we can do with curriculum these days. And obviously, Ontario is a bit of a hot button these days in terms of any similarly related curriculum.
Yeah, I'm doing an analysis of the Ontario curriculum for my dissertation, and it's been really interesting to kind of navigate that. But I guess we could have that conversation another time because we're running out of time. But as part of the show, we play rapid fire fill in the blanks if you're interested.
Okay, sure.
All right. So my favorite cereal.
Oh, Captain Crunch for sure.
Oh, me too.
There you go.
Who would say anything else?
Well, yeah.
Like my mouth is destroyed and I'm like, the box will be dead.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's fine, but it's still so good.
If I had a magic power, it would be?
Time travel.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, time travel.
I sure. Like it. So something I'm working on that no one would expect me to be working on.
Well, I don't know if no one expected me, but I think I'm becoming a good chef. I mean, my dad was a chef, so I don't know what the expectation is, but no one knows of it, of me, just because, you know, there's my tech stuff and I don't put much about it online. So yeah, kind of a foodie. Yeah.
Okay. The last question here is one thing that we can do to spread light online.
Spread light online?
Yes.
I like that term. Mm-hmm. It's really being light. It's being that person. There's so much toxicity online. Mm. I think we have to remember that, you know, a lot of it's not only negative people who have had a hard day and that sort of thing, or you know, political trolls or whatever it is. There's bots. Like, there's all sorts of things that are creating a toxic culture online. And a lot of those things are out of our control, but they're designed to create a culture online. All we can do to fight back is just be that person, you know, that we want other people to be, to interact with people with care and politeness. And you know, I almost said the F word online, and I was thinking, I've never done that. I'm not going to do it. Like, I just never done that. And just because I was describing what someone else had said.
Right.
I don't need to say that. I can use asterisks and so on. And yeah, so it's not that. And I might say it face to face, but it's like, there's no point for me saying that. I don't know who's reading this. Mm-hmm. And so it's just being kind as much as we possibly can to each other. And doing that online is a big part of that, because I think it can, you know, we overdo our... we project and we perform all sorts of perform things that we aren't online, but let's, at least if we're going to do it, let's do it in really kind and nice ways. So if we're going to overperform in anything, let's not do the face touching up and whatever else. Let's actually just make sure that we be the people we want to be online, as you know, in any way that we possibly can. So there's lots of opportunities for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I think a lot about swearing on the podcast, and like, I don't swear regularly in my everyday life, yeah. but I asked a listener, I was like, is it a little bit lame that I'm not swearing?
I know. It's a teacher in me. Like, I just can't do it. It's weird. And then other people that I, you know, regularly work with, like, I can't even with work friends sometimes. It's bizarre.
Yeah, exactly. Alrighty, if our listeners want to get a hold of you, is there a way that you would prefer that they do that?
Carose@gmail.com always works. If anyone has any particular questions, I'm always happy to connect there. So just my last name @gmail.com, and I'm @carose.ca.
Okay, perfect.
Want to find out more? Yeah. You know, if I come into schools, I try to talk to teachers, kids, and adults as much as I can to get everyone on the same message. It's really important to me, because if there's just one part of that, I mean, sort of like going back to the idea of, you know, trying to teach people at different stages. I think that's what we do. That works best with professional development or professional learning, that we have to make sure that the entire culture understands the message that we're trying to create. Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Your opportunity.
And thank you for tuning in each week and supporting the show. Until next time, shine light online, and I'll talk to you soon.